How are you observing your experience without judgment? I mean, that's what mindfulness is, being present, breathing, observing, not judging. All of those things really help people, whether they're having a sexual interaction or having a relationship, or if they're on the job, having an observational, compassionate relationship with yourself really sets you up well to have the things you want in life and experience what you want in life.
Welcome to the Unconditionally Worthy podcast. In this podcast, I will guide you on your journey to connect with the true source of your self-worth. Each week, we'll discuss barriers to unconditional self-worth, the connection between self-worth and relationships, self-worth practices you can apply to your life, and how to use self-worth as a foundation for living courageously. I'm your host, Dr. Adia Gooden, a licensed clinical psychologist, dance enthusiast, and a dark chocolate lover who believes deeply that you are worthy unconditionally. Hello, and welcome to episode 18 of the Unconditionally Worthy podcast. We have an amazing guest on this episode for you today. Her name is Dr. Alexandra Solomon. She is a licensed clinical psychologist. She is an expert couples therapist, and she has written two best-selling books. We had an amazing conversation. It was rich with wisdom. Dr. Alexandra talks about her framework of relational self-awareness, which is really about how our relationships with ourselves set the foundation for us to have healthy romantic relationships. This is an opportunity to hear from an expert in this area. And we also talk about sex and, you know, a topic that we don't often talk about in a healthy way. And Alexandra shares her perspective on women taking sexy back, which is the title of her second book, Taking Sexy Back. So you're going to want to tune in. And what you'll notice in our conversation is that the foundation for all of these things is a healthy relationship with self. I'm really excited to introduce you to Dr. Alexandra Solomon, who has come on to share a wealth of wisdom today. There are so many ways that I look up to Alexandra, and I'm excited to share her with you. So let me tell you about her. Dr. Alexandra Solomon has become one of today's most trusted voices in the world of relationships, and her work on relational self-awareness has reached millions of people around the world. Dr. Solomon is a licensed clinical psychologist at the Family Institute at Northwestern University, and she is on faculty in the School of Education, Social Policy, and Social Policy at Northwestern University, where she teaches the internationally renowned course, Building Loving and Lasting Relationships, Marriage 101. Don't we all need that? In addition to writing articles and chapters for leading academic journals and books in the field of marriage and family, she is the author of two best-selling books, Loving Bravely and Taking Sexy Back. Dr. Solomon regularly presents to diverse groups that include the United States Military Academy at West Point, Microsoft, and she is frequently asked to talk about relationships with media outlets like The Today Show, O Magazine, The Atlantic, Vogue, and Scientific American. So you can see why I feel so honored that she is taking out time in her busy schedule to talk with me today. And I just really look up to Dr. Alexandra because she has an incredible ability to translate learnings and knowledge that we have in the mental health field as psychologists and make it plain for the public so that everyone can understand and benefit and use it in their lives. And she has a unique perspective and a wise perspective on relationships and how we relate to ourselves and how that influences our relationships with others. And that's what I'm really excited to talk about today. So, Alexandra, thank you so much for being here.
Adia, it is such a treat to be with you. Like, I feel like I'm just always going to be a yes when there's a chance for our paths to cross, because I was thinking as you were introducing me, so much of what you were naming about what you admire in me, which I appreciate and I put right in my heart, it is just what I also admire about you. And I was thinking about how our paths first crossed when you were like just a budding clinical psychologist. And yes. I asked you to do a guest lecture in the Marriage 101 course. And you just like hit it so far out of the park that like you couldn't even see the park. I mean, I remember You, Wolf, you were lecturing about when love bridges cultural difference, and you wove together clips from Grey's Anatomy. Do you remember this?
I remember that.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it was the April and the hot doctor.
Yeah.
I don't remember. They were bridging a faith difference, right? And it was, and you had used that as your starting point, and you did a beautiful job of bridging the research with what happens in the therapy office. And then this is a class, you know, for undergraduate students. And so you made it all really tangible for them. So anyways, and you've grown from there and I've grown from there, and we just keep finding ways to be in each other's spaces. And I love it. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And thanks for giving me the opportunity back in the day to do that guest lecture. It was so much fun. So, you know, I'm starting all of the episodes with guests with a question and an opportunity for the guests to share a little bit about their own self-worth journeys. So I'd love for you to share some of that with us today.
Yeah. When we were prepping for this episode and I saw that question, I thought, oh, well, okay, we're just going to go,
there. I right in.
Yeah. And so it was lovely because it let me, you know, invited and challenged me to do some reflecting on my own self-worth journey. And I think that I suspect, you know, I'm well into my 40s now, and I am still working with my own sense of worthiness. And I would say that I am in recovery. I'm a recovering hustler for worthiness. And I feel like I have many, many more tools at my disposal now. And I know the ways in which I can get caught, right? Where I can get caught kind of like hustling and bargaining and negotiating for a sense of worth. And when I was thinking about this question, I was thinking the two domains where I'm at risk really do go back to when I was a little girl. And one is around, you know, I was a little girl in a complicated family where I often played the family counselor and then, no surprise, became a therapist. And so a lot of the way when I was a little girl, a lot of the way I would anchor my worth was around, am I helpful? Am I able to provide comfort and care to big people who matter to me, who are in pain? And so I know that that is one of the ways I can set myself up even today around, am I being helpful enough? Am I doing enough? Mm-hmm. So that's one of my kind of like hooks where I can get hooked. Mm-hmm. And the other one I was thinking about is tracing back. I'm the daughter of like a literal beauty queen. Like my mom was a model and like a beauty, like in the back of the convertible in the parade.
Oh,
like,
wow.
And so when I was little, I was like, okay, so like, I can't be that because she is that, right? No. She is striking beyond. And so what am I? I'm smart. And so I really, when I was little, identified so much of my worth in, okay, I can't be pretty because my mom is just like, there's
taking that.
But I can do school. And so I know that there's another kind of hook for me around achievement, accomplishment, and that I can start to get kind of hustly around my worth, around, am I sort of doing enough, achieving enough? Those are some of the places where I have learned over the years, right, with the support of therapists and colleagues and friends, to kind of know myself well enough to know where I can get, where I'm still at risk of questioning my worth as a being versus, you know, a doer.
I mean, I so appreciate you sharing so honestly. One of the things that I think is really powerful just about how you framed it is this sort of observer relationship. Like, I notice I can get hooked. This is the context I came from. This is how I made sense of it as a kid. This is how it, you know, can play out. And I can get hooked by that. There's no judgment of your little self. There's no judgment, right? It's just like, this is what I came up in. There's no judgment of your parents. And I'm sure you've worked through that a lot, but it's just such a wonderful way of framing it because it makes it workable. It's not, oh, I'm awful. I can't believe I got hooked again. But yeah, this will hook me and this will pull me in, and then I'll notice it and I'll have to come back out, and then I'll understand, oh, this is why I was being pulled in that way. And it just is such a compassionate way of understanding the journey, and that it's an ongoing process, and that you may be doing really well with being grounded in your worth and embracing it, and then something might hook you and catch you off guard, and that you can notice that and pull back out. And I just think that's such a wonderful way to frame it.
I love what you're saying too about in that like observer, and you're sort of like naming that process for how we get hooked and then kind of pull ourselves back out. But you're also reminding us that there are moments in time when we're more at risk of getting hooked and moments of time when we're less at risk of getting hooked. And I know for myself, I'm more at risk of getting hooked around big transitions and new experiences. Those are time, right? Which I think makes sense. Like stepping into something I haven't done before, or there's a transition I'm trying to kind of like orient myself to my life and to my context. And that's when I will start to feel like I'm on shakier ground. Does that land for you?
Yeah. And how powerful to be able to know that and anticipate it, right? Because if you can anticipate it, you can say, okay, this might be a challenging space for me. I'm not going to know exactly what to do. I'm not going to know how to navigate. And so what are the grounding practices, the soothing practices, the self-compassion practices that I could put in place to best prepare myself for this challenging transition or whatever it is, so that if I get hooked, I maybe can get off the hook quickly, or I maybe won't get hooked. And that is sort of like being in relationship with yourself in a really healthy way. It's not expecting yourself to get perfect, but it's saying, okay, we're going to go through a tough time. How do we prepare? How do we kind of gather our resources, mental, emotional, social, and support ourselves during this time, because we're human and humans have challenges during transitions or other things, and we can accommodate that.
As you say that, I'm thinking about before we started recording, I was telling you that we just launched our oldest son to college. And so, you know, sort of talk about a transition. And in the time leading up to the transition, I was doing a ton of looking in the rearview mirror, you know, have I done enough? And is he ready? And sort of like wanting to grade my mothering. Number one, as if it can even have a grade. And number two, as if it's done, it's not done, you know, but it was such a time of like looking back and reflecting. And I was having a crappy day where I was beating myself up, and I called my best friend, who's been my best friend since we were 10. And I just like, bleh, like I let it all out, you know, building my case for all the ways in which I had failed and you know, she's like, are you done? Are you done now? We got more in there? What else? Like, what else needs to come out? You know, it just, it's like so beautiful when we have somebody who can hear it with us, right?
Yeah. And I think what I hear in that is like, I'm scared for my son, right? Like, is he going to be okay? And have I done everything I could to make sure he's going to be okay? Because I love him so much and I cannot tolerate him not being okay. And so now, because it's hard to be in that feeling, I'm going to like go back and say, well, you didn't do that one time. And you said this and you know, and it's such a common pattern, whether it's parenting or something else we did. It's like our hurt, our care, our love can sometimes like spur this criticism because it just feels too big to hold.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you for, I mean, sharing that. I think already this conversation is so rich. And one of the things I really want to get into, and I'd love for you to talk about, is relational self-awareness, because I think that what we're talking about, how we are aware of ourselves, aware of our hooks, aware of all of these things, feeds into relational self-awareness. So could you share about that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, I wear a few different hats in my work, right? So sometimes I'm teaching and sometimes I'm doing therapy. And then sometimes I'm doing this more translational work of translating research and clinical wisdom into tool, you know, relationship education tools. But what I noticed, a number of years ago is that no matter what domain I was in, I was always basically coming back to this through line that is about what I now call relational self-awareness. The idea that the healthiest foundation for intimate partnership is an ongoing, curious, and compassionate relationship with self. And there are so many reasons that we can get into about why, especially in intimate partnership, it is just so easy to say, if you would be different, this problem would go away. Mm-hmm. Or that's the blame, right? That's the finger pointing. The like, you know, I can see all the ways in which you're too this and not enough this. And if you didn't have this quirk, we wouldn't be having this problem. Mm-hmm. It also can go the other way, which is sort of the shame story of I'm too broken. My trauma's too big. Mm-hmm. I'm not enough. But in either of those places, the blame space or the shame space, we're not doing what a healthy, intimate relationship needs, which is the ability to look at the dance and the sequence and the pattern and to kind of hold what I call the golden equation of love, which is my stuff plus your stuff equals our stuff. Mm. And when we start to map out that dance and the way in which we, you know, in intimate partnership, we have these like brilliantly complicated ways in which we just set each other off. You know, it just happens. It's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's not, the problem isn't that it happens. The problem is when we don't know what to do with it. So we just get locked into either the blame or the shame. So that's what the heart of relational self-awareness is, just inviting people into that perspective and providing tools for how to hold that perspective, how to return to it when we've lost it. And that becomes kind of like the heartbeat of all of the work I do.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's so powerful and so countercultural. Right? Like it's so counter to how we in the sort of broader public see relationships, whether that's romantic or familial or political, right? Like we are so often in a space of who is to blame. That is so often the space that we end up in, right? This lack of nuance, this pointing fingers. And I think it's such an important shift that you're helping people make, which is, okay, what's my stuff? Not to feel totally ashamed of it. What's your stuff, right? And what's our stuff and how do we navigate this? I think, you know, I'm sure you see this all the time in couples therapy. And when I do couples therapy, often a big first step is how do you get each partner out of the, I'm bringing them here to change so you can change them. So you can tell them that I'm right about them.
I think that's right. I tell that story. That example is so true. Every first session is like that. And do you know, I went to the United Center when Michelle Obama's Becoming book was first published and Oprah interviewed her. And she talked in that event about how when she and Barack went to couples therapy, that was in her inside of Michelle's thinking bubble was like, oh, thank God we're here. Now this therapist can help Barack understand how to be a different Barack, right? So, you know, like that was just like, okay, I mean, this is so universal. And this is so like, we need compassion for the ways in which we do this. And we need tools for not getting stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. It's the research, you know that the research, the sort of like common factors research, like in the world of therapy, there's, you know, different crews who have different approaches to couples therapy. There's the integrative behavioral couples therapists, and there's the emotion focused therapists and all those different branches. But when Jay LeBeau and his team looked across all the therapy models, one of the things they found is that every single model for doing couples therapy has some procedure, some way to get people from that myopic view into that relational, choreographic, it's the dance, it's the cycle, it's the pattern. Every approach has a way of doing that because it just, that's what creates pain in couples.
Yep.
And then the relational frame is what creates healing and new possibility for couples.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I think it's so important. Do you have things that you share? I mean, I know you've written a whole book on this, right? Like you have a TEDx talk on this, right? You've talked about this a lot, but for the people who are kind of like, like I never heard of this before. Or I never thought about it this way. Do you have things that you share or recommend as like a starting place to like, hey, start to think about this or start to observe this?
I love it. Right. I mean, there's obviously like tons of resources out there, but what's a really, I think a really beautiful practice that people can start doing today is something that Eli Finkel, who is a faculty member at Northwestern, did research years ago, where he basically, the short story of the research is that relationship satisfaction is improved when during a conflict, people stop, they walk away from each other. And they sit and they write down, and you could do this as a note on your phone or an old school writing, where you write down the story of the conflict from the perspective of a neutral third party who loves you both very much. So it's literally like writing, Adia is feeling like this and Alexandra is feeling like this. And what Adia wishes is that Alexandra would da da da. And what Alexandra wishes is that Adia could just da 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 da. That practice forces the mind and the heart into a more compassionate stance and a more relational Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, a really simple practice that, because we know from the research, there's no such thing as a conflict-free relationship. But the couples who make it, who thrive, who enjoy longevity and good health and connection, are the couples who know what to do when conflict hits. And that's a really, I'm curious what your thoughts are on that practice, but I think it's such a powerhouse.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes so much sense, right? Because it takes people out of sort of the emotionally charged place where you feel when you're in conflict into, you know, and maybe you'll have to do some self-soothing or some self-compassion before you're able to write out what somebody else might see as a conflict. But it takes you into that observer place and also into what are the facts of what's happening, right? And what do I want? What do they want? And that's often what sort of gets muddled in an argument, right? Because people aren't necessarily saying, hey, I'm scared about blah, blah, blah. So I'm wondering about us doing this differently. It's why are you doing it that way? You know? And it's like, woo, you know, if you can pull back and say, well, I'm scared about this. Sometimes it's even clarifying for yourself and it calms you down to see, oh, my partner isn't just trying to be my enemy and attack me and hurt me. They actually may have some wants, needs, desires that are playing out in this situation. And I wonder if I could make space to hear them without that making me wrong, but to kind of hold that space together because of the kind of my stuff, their stuff, our stuff, golden formula that you shared before. How do we make room for all of that?
Beautiful. Well, you just, I mean, embedded in that, you just gave another really, really, really important tool, which is like the sort of like the way that therapists often say it, like behind every complaint is an unmet need, right? Mm-hmm. So you're saying like what comes out of our mouth is, why are you doing that? Mm-hmm. It's a finger pointy, why are you doing that? That's the criticism, but behind the criticism is an unmet need. I'm scared. I'm lonely. I miss you. I feel devalued. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling self-critical. And so I'm feeling like you're being critical. That's, yep. You know, the idea of when, like starting to catch ourselves, and it, you know, I want everyone's partners, I want the listeners' partners to also start to catch themselves, that when we are criticizing, what is it? You know, I do this, I've been married for almost 23 years now. And one of my practices is that when I get so frustrated with Todd, okay, why? Why is that so frustrating? Mm-hmm. What's going on inside of me? What's the unmet need? Mm-hmm. And rather than, why are you doing that? Can I pause? Can I regulate myself? Yep. Can I ground myself? And can I peel back that layer? What's going on inside of me? And how might I reach a bit differently for mm-hmm. him? A different means, maybe to the same end.
I want you to stay tuned because I am launching a course at the very end of September, beginning of October of 2021, that is all about building a healthy relationship with yourself. This is an incredible course that guides you step by step to build a healthy, compassionate, accepting relationship with yourself. And so make sure you stay tuned, stay on my email. If you're not on my email, get on my email list. The link will be in the bio. And look out for this course because it's going to be really powerful and it's going to support so many of the things that I talk about on this podcast and then we talk about in the episode today.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I think that process that you just described really goes back to where you started with explaining what relational self-awareness is, which is it's about your relationship with yourself, right? And that being the foundation of being able to have a healthy relationship with others. And I think about our relationships with ourselves as a foundation to embracing unconditional self-worth. And I think when those things are present, right, when we have a healthy, loving, encouraging relationship with ourselves, there is that space to hold ourselves, to self-soothe, and we're less worried if, you know, if our worthiness is at stake, if this partner has to accept us perfectly and do everything we want and all of that in order for us to feel worthy, the pressure is on. Right? Like, woo, like get ready. But if we know we're worthy, if we know how to self-soothe, if we know how to be there for ourselves, of course we want love and acceptance from our partner. And of course it'll feel bad if it doesn't come. And the pressure for them to conform or align with exactly what we need to do, exactly how they need to affirm us, just lowers. And then there's more room for a conversation that says, you know, that hurt me. That was disappointing and that hurt me. Not like, you must hate me, you know, and all of the things that can people feel viscerally in relationships when they feel the sense of rejection. If there's no grounding in your relationship with yourself or your self-worth, it's so hard to tolerate it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's right. The stakes become so high. And as you were talking about that, I was just like, imagine like being on this tightrope, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's the stakes are high because I need this, because this moment has either the power to affirm me or destroy me.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, it goes without saying, because your listeners know you and they know your work, we come by our lack of self-worth from really, really, really understandable means, right? We don't struggle with self-worth because we suck. We struggle with self-worth for all kinds of reasons. And what you're saying is any work we do on our own affirmation just becomes, it just widens us out for intimacy, for close, yeah, for a moment to just be a moment.
Yeah.
Rather than the sum total of who you are, who I am, who we are we doomed? Are we going to make, you know, all of that?
Yes. Yes. And I think so many people, I know I did this for years, think if I get the relationship, then I'll be worthy. Then I'll be okay. Then I'll know I'm good enough, right? Like I need the partnership, the ring. I need these things. It's this outside in approach, right? And it's just a setup, right? It's a setup for individuals seeking love. It's a setup for the relationship. And it makes things so difficult, right? And, you know, certainly people can have relationships and healthy relationships while they're still on their self-worth journey. That happens all the time. And, you know, it's not like you have to fully embrace your self-worth in order for you to have a healthy relationship. And I'd love for you to speak to how you see challenges with self-worth and low self-worth sort of showing up in the couples therapy you do. And when you're working with couples, like, how do you see that coming into the relationship?
Mm-hmm. I think what you just said is so, so, so important around this idea that I will be worthy when I have the relationship. I think especially for those of us who've been socialized in the feminine, for women, that's not something that any given woman makes up out of thin air. That is like thousands of years of patriarchy that says like, literally, yes, you can't be until you are married. You aren't until you are married, right? Mm-hmm. So even just that belief system is not something that anybody just like comes, you know, creates like that. That's patriarchal messaging big time. And I also love what you said about how we don't have to be done. Like that's oftentimes, I feel like I'm giving that message a lot of, there certainly is like a baseline we have to have within ourselves so that we're not looking for the relationship to complete us or affirm us. And there are parts of our healing we can't do until we are in, well, there are parts of our healing that no matter what we've done, there are parts of our healing that are going to have to get redone, reimagined, revisited as we fall in love. Because the nature of falling in love is so profound. It's so destabilizing. It's so reorganizing, right? That whatever you've done, whatever you think you got in place, it's like, okay, revisit. rework in the context of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that I like to think about related to the self-worth journey is that you're learning a different way of being with yourself, right? It's not a destination. It's not something that you check off, but it's, I now relate to myself in a new way. I am learning a new way to treat myself, to see myself, to take care of myself. And that means that it doesn't mean there's not going to be challenges or bumps or issues along the way. But when those things come up, I have ways of navigating them, ways of relating to them. And that makes sense, right? Like when you're falling in love and when you're building a life with another human being and all of these things, right? Things will come up. And how are you orienting? Are you saying, oh, things came up, this relationship is wrong, I'm wrong, I can never do this? Or are you saying, okay, right? Like, oh, this is hard, this is challenging. Like, how do we lean into it? How do we get curious? How do we, ooh, this is reminding me of my relationship with my mother. Okay, like this is stirring up some stuff. Like that's relational self-awareness. And that's sort of like, how are you orienting? You're not getting to a destination and you're like, I'm on the top of the hill. Nothing will ever bother me ever again. right? Like you're not becoming a monk, most likely, right? But I have a new way of moving through the world and through my relationships.
I love it. Because even if there can't be a done because the context keeps changing, right? Then you have a baby or then your baby grows up or then there's an illness or then there's a job loss or then like even then we get older, whatever, you know, whatever sort of beliefs I had around my body, you know, in my 30s, those have got to get reorganized and reoriented in my 40s and are going to have to again in my 50s, you know, like there's the context keeps changing. You're right. But when you asked a minute ago about how I see it show up in couples therapy, and there's so many answers to that, right? Like, I think what can be really challenging is that because the like projective process, like the idea of if you would just be different, because that gets so strong, I find it's really challenging as a couples therapist to start to invite people into questions of relationship with self because it can feel really threatening. I find especially, I think because the way we socialize boys and men is so much around that like right, wrong, winner, loser. And mm-hmm. So I think for men, like the questions of self-worth can play out around that. Like I have to be right to be worthy. And so then that invitation to see it from your partner's perspective is so hard, not because it's so hard to see something from someone's perspective, but because if I do that, how the hell am I going to feel worthy? How the hell do I quote unquote accept defeat and feel worthy? Mm-hmm. So I think there can be different blocks that are gendered blocks, but I think that's like, I can feel it. Like I can just intuitively in my bones feel this man is so locked in because his whole sense of worth is hung up in this. But how the F am I going to get us there? Because that also means that he spent a lifetime building this story. And it's just like chip, 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 you know, like gently kind of shifting and inviting a wider, gentler, richer sense of who you get to be. Like you get to be okay just because you are. You don't have to be right. You don't have to win. You just are.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think about, you know, some of the couples I've worked with that, you know, the patience and the holding the space for it. Right. And then not like going straight at like, well, you need to think about your self-worth. It sounds like it's your fault. Right. But like the, like holding space. And some of it is like letting people come to the conclusion without saying a direct, right? Like, can you see what your part, you know what I mean? Like creating the opportunity for that perspective taking without like a, you need to see your, what your partner's understanding because it feels like a challenge. I think one of the other things I've noticed in the couples I've worked with is the difficulty taking in the love of the other partner and trusting the love of a partner when someone doesn't feel worthy themselves. And right, like this frustration of one partner saying, but I'm showing you and I'm telling you and I'm giving to you. And the other partner saying, but I don't know, right? Like, I don't know if I believe or trust or can take that in, and how painful that is for both partners. One partner longing for love and affirmation, but not being able to receive and accept it. And one partner trying their best to show and give it, but feeling frustrated that it isn't being received.
I feel like it was a number of years ago where I felt like this hit me like a brick to my head of like, oh, it's like, there's a massive common thread that's about how freaking difficult it is to just let yourself be loved. Like that, like, it seems like that's the easy part. Like someone's trying to love you. How is it? And then it's like, oh no, but that's actually a massive surrender and a massive risk. And what you're saying is it's a massive confrontation because it's a contrast with my own story that I don't deserve it. I shouldn't trust it. I can't rest in this. If I let you in, then what happens next? Like that whole thing. And I've watched relationships like absolutely dissolve because somebody's own issues of worth just wreak havoc and just sabotage. And the other person, as you're describing, just ends up feeling starving, right? Like I have something to give and I'm just hitting this wall and I've exhausted myself. Yep. I've exhausted myself. I've offered affirmation. I've done it this way. I've added jazz hands. So they still won't just feel okay about themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and I think I hope that helps people not to feel like, oh God, I have to wait for love, but to feel like, yeah, this investment in myself, in loving myself and caring myself for myself is worth it, because it's not only for me, it's also for the relationship and the type of life and the type of family. If you want to build a family, I want to build. And that is a foundation of it.
Beautiful. I think sometimes the bypass or like the workaround is I will let you love me because I can tell you want to love me, right? So like, it's going to make you feel good if I let you love. Like there are times where that's the place where I'm like, okay, I think here's the slice, you know, here's the amount that let's start with this. Can you get your mind around it is loving of them to let them love you? So do it for them as a first step. If it feels too much to just receive because you, of course, deserve to receive.
Yep.
So let's maybe just start with the first baby bite.
Right.
It'll make them feel good.
Yeah.
Like, you know, let them shine on you.
Make have to feel. Have those hooks and those ins and those like, okay, how do we start to make this easier for you? For sure. So another thing that I wanted to talk a bit about is sex. And your second book is Taking Sexy Back. And, you know, I think, you know, sex is not often talked about in a constructive way. I think that's changing. But I think one of the powerful things about the book is that you are encouraging, I think, mostly women, people who identify as women, to really own their sexuality and their sexual pleasure. And I think that's really powerful. And so I'd love for you to share a bit about kind of your thoughts about what does it mean to take sexy back? And what do you kind of recommend for people in that vein?
I mean, I feel like everything we've talked about so far in this conversation, the volume gets turned up to 1,000 when we're talking about sex, right? Because there's that much more risk, that much more vulnerability, that many more shame-loaded messages that we've internalized from our culture around we're only worthy if our body looks like this, our genitals look like this, we make love like this, we express like this, right? There's so much knocking around inside of our heads. I will be worthy when, or I'm only worthy if, when it comes to sex. And the vulnerability is so much more. So we end up grasping those messages even more. So this book was really necessary. I feel like in some ways this book wrote me, you know, I feel like it just kind of came through me in a really powerful way. And, you know, you had used the expression before of like this outside in approach. And that's what we're doing in the book is the idea for women, you know, we all have some relationship with the word sexy, right? Like what it means to be sexy. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it is this idea that somebody else decides our own desirability, our own beauty, our own authority to access the erotic. And so in this book, we turn the word sexy into a noun. And so it's basically the book is couples therapy between the reader and her sexy, capital S. And your sexy is your sexual self. It's your erotic self. And so in the book, you get to know her, right? Like, what is her story? Where is her pain? What has she been denied? What is she craving? What is she curious about? And the hope is, of course, as we've been saying during this whole conversation, that my own relationship with my sexy creates the foundation for any kind of sexual experience I might have with somebody else. And so that's what we have to kind of claim, reorganize, get to know before we can really show up with a partner and even have a clue where our boundaries are, where our needs are. How might I know whether you are somebody that it's safe and fun for me to be sexual with? All that stuff is predicated upon, I got to get myself right. Like I got to get myself figured out. What have I internalized? What am I carrying that does not belong to me? And what are the tools I need to show up for sex that makes me feel good? Because the research, I mean, you know, the research is just, especially for women who make love with men, the research is really upsetting. There's a huge orgasm. It's not just there's a huge orgasm gap between for women who are making love with men, their chances of orgasm are much less than their male partner's chances of orgasm or their chances of orgasm if they were making love to another woman. So there's an orgasm gap for women who make love with men. And there's also like kind of an everything gap. There's like an overall pleasure gap. Mm-hmm. Lots of women tolerate pain and discomfort mm-hmm. during sex with male partners. And so it just feels like we need and deserve some time to like journey into ourselves and realize how we've just been done dirty by our culture. We've been, you know, we have been given a whole lot of really problematic messages. And I hope it's a book. I have been so touched when I hear about men, especially men who make love with women. I want those men to read the book too, so that they can understand why it might be difficult for a female. I mean, I've heard so many stories of men who are like, no, I want her to tell me what she wants. I want to make her feel good. And she won't tell me. I'm like, whoever supported her even knowing what makes her feel good. So she's not deprived. I suspect she's not depriving you of an answer. She just needs to figure it out a bit first.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the book is incredibly empowering, right? I think women are socialized to be very passive around sex, right? And often the message is don't get pregnant, don't get pregnant, don't get pregnant, close your legs, don't get pregnant, right? Like that's the beginning and the end of like sex education, right? Not like explore what feels good for you. You're worthy of pleasure. You should be enjoying it too. This should be a mutually pleasurable experience. Figure out what you like, right? And I also think this power of like, you have to figure out what you like. And certainly that can be done in with a partner, and expecting a partner to just know what to do or like know what gets you off or that. I mean, it's unreasonable. And so it's, I think, helping women to sort of both think about what are the societal and psychological barriers, challenges that they have that might be blocking their pleasure, and then helping them sort of own their sexy and have a healthy relationship with it is so powerful. And I also, you know, of course, think about the intersections with self-worth, right? If you don't feel worthy, or you feel like, oh, my body needs to be different for me to be worthy. Like all of this kind of makes it hard to just relax and feel pleasure, right? If you don't allow yourself to rest, if you don't allow yourself to have fun, if you don't, you know, if all of these things aren't in place because you feel like you always have to be working or hustling or proving or that sort of thing, or even if sex is all about pleasuring a partner and not about you, that makes it very hard to relax and enjoy, and it makes it hard to have an orgasm. And so I think providing women with the tools to explore these things in a way that's free from shame and what's wrong with you and you did something wrong, and even to own like it's okay to want to have sex, and it's okay to want to have sex that feels good. You're worthy of that. That's healthy, is really powerful.
Mm, yes. All of that. Absolutely. I think that one of the points that you just made, I think that's so important is, and it's a perfect storm, because if women are taught to be passive, which we for sure are, and if we are kind of hustling for worthiness, then sex becomes a performance.
Mm.
And when we are focusing on performing, we certainly, in order to get it right, in order to feel okay, then you're right. The pleasure, pleasure and performance do not go together. Mm-hmm. And so any work that we do outside of the bedroom around worthiness practices, grounding practices, mindfulness and self-compassion practices, those get to come into the bedroom with us. And so then the bedroom becomes another arena where we can start to notice,
mm-hmm.
oh, I'm doing that thing again where I'm more focused on how my thighs look than how I feel right now. Like how beautiful it is to have my arms around my partner, to feel my partner's hair against me. That there are ways that, in fact, the woman who wrote the foreword to Taking Sexy Back is a researcher named Dr. Lori Brado. And she, the research shows that just about half of women struggle with compromised sexual desire. It's a really very high number of us who just like, there's just a lot of blocks, and the blocks are psychological and societal and hormonal, all this kind of stuff. But she did some research where she taught women mindfulness practices, bringing your attention back to the moment, focusing on your senses, focusing on sensation, following sensation. And she found that those women, as they learned mindfulness practices, they had increases in desire, in arousal, in lubrication, in orgasm, in relationship satisfaction. Like it was a little intervention that packed quite a punch for all the reasons that you know, because this is the work that you're so passionate about, of like when you have ways of bringing yourself to this moment with worthiness, without questioning, do I deserve this? You get to just savor what's there. And you get to make sure that the conditions are there for you to savor, right? So that you know you and your partner are going to do the things that feel good and not do the things that don't feel good. And that your partner, you've chosen a partner who is interested in your feedback, who you can give feedback to, all of that.
Right. I mean, there's so much there, right? Like, do you feel you're worthy of boundaries and saying, no, I'm not comfortable with that, or I'm comfortable with this? Can you be present enough to notice my body is like not feeling comfortable? Like, what's going on? Right. And there's so many things. And I love that you tied in the mindfulness intervention. And I think, you know, there's a reason why so many roads lead back to how are you relating to yourself? You know, how are you observing your experience without judgment? I mean, that's what mindfulness is: being present, breathing, observing, not judging. All of those things really help people, whether they're having a sexual interaction or having a relationship, or if they're on the job, like having an observational, compassionate relationship with yourself really sets you up well to have the things you want in life and experience what you want in life. So, you know, this conversation has been so rich and I'm so grateful for it. I'm wondering if you have any final thoughts that you'd like to share with the listeners, or any points that you want to just make sure people take away from this conversation.
You know, we've said it before, but because I know how sneaky this stuff is, I think it's worth saying again that whatever you've heard Adia and I say that kind of like you have some kind of a reaction to, or you're like, oh, that's me. That moment of like, oh, that's me, must be met with self-compassion. Like, oh, that's me. And I can see it and I can be so gentle with it. Because I think we can get kind of sneaky as we're doing this stuff and we identify, okay, that's me. And now I've got to intervene, criticize it, kind of beat it out of me. And so it's like this, you know, it's like this iterative process where when we find a point of unworthiness, rather than beating ourselves up for that point of unworthiness, it has to get wrapped in self-compassion. That's the only way that we heal, right? Is to meet it with gentleness, to comfort it like you would comfort an upset little kid, right? That's what these little pain points inside of us need and deserve and are asking for. And it's stuff that we've named, like that big cultural context that informs this. Mm-hmm. Family context that we grow up in, that those are all we come in with all of this, and we have the chance to kind of keep working and refining it.
Yes, to self-compassion. I totally agree. I think especially for those high achievers, right? Like that's a thing for me. It's like, I did something wrong. Okay. How do I fix it? What did I do? You know, like going into this, like, overdrive, like, how do I fix it? It's like, oof, like the first thing is to pause and breathe and be like, oh, baby, that's a hard one, man. Right. And I also think you provided such a great model at our start with like, yeah, the family I grew up in led me to have this response and how I made sense of it, because every single one of us has that, right? And often therapy is so helpful in sort of uncovering like, what is it? What was going on there that led me to this way of being and making sense of the world? But we all come by it honestly. And that's what contextualizing it can help us offer ourselves a lot of compassion for it. So thank you again, Alexandra. I know that people are going to want to be able to connect with you, to check out your book. So I'd love for you to share where people can connect with you, learn more about you, buy your books, all that good stuff.
Yeah. Well, the best place to go is my website, which is just dralexandrasolomon.com. And there's a ton of resources there, lots and lots of blog articles, links to e-courses and books and social media. So I'm active on Instagram, which is just dr.alexandra.solomon, and post there just about every day something about relationships. So yep, that's a great place to start.
Please make sure to follow Dr. Alexandra on Instagram. It's linked in the bio. And let us know. Send us a DM. How did you like the episode? What did you take from it? We would love to hear your feedback.
Thank you again so much. I know that the listeners are going to find this so very valuable, and I really appreciate it.
It was a treat to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining me this week on the Unconditionally Worthy podcast. Make sure to visit my website, dradiagooden.com, and subscribe to the show on iTunes so you'll never miss an episode. You can also follow me on social media at Dr. Adia Gooden. If you love the show, please leave a review on iTunes so we can continue to bring you amazing episodes. Lastly, if you found this episode helpful and know someone who might benefit from hearing it, please share it. Thanks for listening and see you next episode. This episode was produced by Chris and Tiana, and the music is by Wadaboy.